Blog Talk Radio.
You have tuned in to the Brain Injury Radio Network with shows 7 nights a week. You can find the network at braininjuryradio.com or look up Brain Injury Radio Network on Facebook.
Another Fork in the Road with your host, Donna O'Donnell Fugerski.
Hi, welcome to the Brain Injury Radio Network on blogtalkradio.com. My name is Donna O'Donnell Fugerski, and I'm your host on my show, Another Fork in the Road. My show airs on the first and third Sundays of every month at 5:30 p.m. Pacific Time. And I always tell folks you can make your conversions across the United States and across the world. So if you're in Eastern time, it's 8:30 your time right now. So another fork in the road is for anyone with a brain injury, anyone who is caring for a brain injured person, or anyone who has any interest in learning more about brain injury. Brain injury is not discriminating. It can happen to anyone, anywhere, and at any time. And believe me, folks, it does. The Brain Trauma Foundation states that there are more than 5 million people in the United States living with some form of brain injury. But you know what? Most folks do not even know about brain injury. And I know that I never did, not until it came to live on my doorstep. And that was back in 2005, so we are pretty good friends now. Well, I don't know if we're friends, but you know what I mean. We're well acquainted. But on another fork in the road, I try to raise awareness of brain injury and to help folks understand what survivors and their caregivers experience, because brain injury is not just a single issue that affects one person. It spreads its little tentacles wide and pulls in the caregivers, the family, the friends. So yes, that's one of the things that we like to talk about here, because we want to know how caregivers are experiencing their changes in their lives too. Sunday of each month, I interview brain injury survivors or caregivers to see how they traverse their world of brain injury. I host therapists, medical professionals, and authors, lots of authors, to gain insight into what they offer survivors. And on the first Sunday of each month, which this is, I host a discussion panel to examine pertinent topics related to brain injury, such as depression or neural fatigue, which just happens to be our topic tonight, anger, or various other symptoms of brain injury. So for those of you who are new to my show, here's a snippet about me. I came on the brain injury scene in 2005, as I mentioned earlier, when my husband David had a brain injury. Again, I didn't know a thing about brain injury. I knew nothing about it. But I learned fast. I learned very fast, as you have to when you are thrown into that deep end of the pool. But you can learn more about that on my blog, SurvivingTraumaticBrainInjury.com. And this is where I always remember to tell folks, please have a pencil and paper nearby so you can jot down URLs that I might want to send out to you or put out to you for you to check into later after the show, because oftentimes there is some good information coming out. So I'll say that one more time. It's SurvivingTraumaticBrainInjury.com. It's all one word, and it's all lowercase. I shared David's and my story in 4 episodes on this very show, starting in August of 2014, when I became the host of Another Fork in the Road, and the last of which was in November 2014. So 4 episodes between August and November, and the last episode featured David himself. So I wanted to get his take on what his brain injury was like for him. So I also interviewed David on April 19, 2020, to show his perspective of his brain injury 16 years later. It's now 18, more than 18 years later. But also because he was a retired professor of microbiology from Columbia University, I wanted to get his understanding of the COVID-19 pandemic. Remember when we were so engulfed in that, and that's all we could talk about or all we could think about? It was overrunning our lives. And David, as a scientist, was able to give us some input in layman's terms. So there's some good things on the blog on survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com for you to check out if you're still interested in that. You can find all of my archive shows on my blog at survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. And if I'm right, I've got about 194 shows up there. And that could be wrong, but David sends me that information every week, and I promptly forget it. But he's always very persistent about sending it, and I'm always persistent about forgetting it. I don't know why. But there are a lot of shows on my blog. So just click on the air show menu. You have to go to the on the air show menu to find all of the links to all of the shows. And there you can find out who the panelists were on the show or what the topic is or who my guest was and what they were all about. So do that in your spare time if anyone has any of that. So, yeah. And if you want to learn more about David, just type in figure ski, F-I-G-U-R-S-K-I, David, in the search box on the right sidebar. You can also read our complete story in my book, Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale, which was published by Right Life Publishing, and it was released in November of 2008. And you can find Prisoners, as I very fondly call it, as a print book, as an ebook, and as an audiobook. And I'm actually the reader of the audiobook, too. I'm really excited about that because you get the author perspective from it. You get my emotional impact from my reading the story. And you can find that at, of course, all your local book cons or your local library. And if they don't have it, ask them to get it. They certainly can. But usually if you go to Amazon.com, for sure, Barnes & Noble, those things, you will find the book there. So please, please get it. Read it. Have fun. And when you do read it, please write a review on Amazon, on Barnes & Noble, and Goodreads, because a review is a book's best friend. And others kind of like them, too. It helps the book to get out there. It helps other people to find it and see it so that they can also can read it and maybe be helped by it. Because I always told my editor when I first was publishing this book, if it helps one person, I've succeeded. So I'm hoping, I know it's already helped lots because I've heard from people that have read it. So I hope you're going to be one of them. So to learn more about me, you can go to my website, donnafigurski.com. I'm going to spell that. donnafigurski.com. And there you can find out all about my book, Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale. There's even a page, look for it, the cast of characters. And so you can see all the different people. There are actual pictures of the people who are playing a part in that book. So for tonight, I hope that you're going to find my show fun and informative. And I hope that you'll visit shows of the other hosts on Brain Injury Radio. There are shows so often. There are shows every night between 7 and 10 p.m. Pacific time. Always look at Pacific time and then translate it into your own time. You can also tune in at 5:30 p.m. Pacific time on weekends to listen to your favorite shows, too, especially the first and third Sundays of every month. But also the second and fourth Sundays have one of my co-hosts runs that show, Mess with MS, so check her out too. Brain Injury Radio broadcasts across the United States, every state, and in 36 different countries. So sit back now, enjoy, and relax if you can too, and enjoy the show. So on that note, I'm going to go right in to fatigue or exhaustion after brain injury with my panelists. So just thinking about fatigue, we all complain about being tired or exhausted every now and then, sometimes even more so for me. It happens, but life gets in the way, and it gets way too busy. So deadlines loom, and with a brain injury complains about being tired or exhausted, they are talking about a completely different level of exhaustion. That exhaustion is called neural fatigue, and can leave one actually feeling debilitated. It can leave one in a state of not being able to function at all. So survivors Megan Beaudry and Don Corbelli and caregiver Bob Millsap are joining me tonight, and we're going to discuss this little understood problem, and I hope that we can shed some light on the matter. At least what you will hear is how neural fatigue is affecting each of these people or their survivor in the case of Bob. Let's go to Megan Beaudry. I want to introduce Megan first. She developed lupus in 2009, which caused a brain inflammation, and she has become a patient advocate for lupus. You can learn more about lupus at lupus.net. Megan began writing as part of her rehabilitation from a brain injury in 2014, and she just never stopped. So her work has been published in Hippocampus, Ravishly, Al Jazeera, and the Huffington Post, to name just a few. When Megan's not writing, she can be found cuddling with her rescue dogs, drinking bubble tea, and teaching students ages 3 to 94 how to play the violin. So you can read about Megan on my blog, survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. And again, in that search box, type her name. It's M-E-G-H-A-N. If you just type that, you'll get Megan. If you type her last name as well, you'll also get her, B-E-A-U-D-R-Y, Megan Beaudry. A survivor's speak out interview will pop up, and so will a show from Another Fork in the Road from March 21st, 2021, on which Megan appeared and was featured. Since then, Megan has been on many panels on Another Fork in the Road. So you can check her out, and you can also follow Megan on Twitter at MeganBeaudry1. Okay? Now, Bob Millsap became a caregiver for his wife when a freak accident occurred in their kitchen, proving that brain injuries can happen anywhere to anyone and anytime. Shelly was in the wrong place when a bottle of homemade soda sitting on her counter exploded. The explosion knocked Shelly unconscious for about 20 minutes. See what I mean about freak accidents? It's really crazy. But with much difficulty, Shelly made her way to an urgent care facility in blizzard-like conditions in a remote area of Idaho. So Shelly now lives with an invisible brain injury. It's invisible to onlookers, but it's not invisible to Shelly. And her husband, Bob, stepped up to be an amazing caregiver for his wife. I know that because Bob and Shelly and my husband, David, and I became friends after learning that we live in the same part of the desert. So Bob and his wife, Shelly, were guests on my show when they discussed Shelly's brain injury and Bob's role as Shelly's caregiver. So if you'd like to hear their complete story, you can go to my blog, again, survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. On the right sidebar, click on the air show menu and scroll to October 16, 2016. So Bob, geez, we go back a long ways by now. And there's a show called Meet the Millsaps. And you can also, of course, type Bob or Shelly's names in the search box to read their interviews and caregivers and survivors speak out. Millsap is M-I-L-L-S-A-P. If you put that in the search box, you'll get anything that Bob and Shelly have done on the blog. Bob also writes a blog called 10,000 Days, and you can check it out at, get this quote, 10,000days.blog. So check that out, but not now. Not now, folks. Wait till after the show. Bob is also the author of his new book, Shake Yourself Free, Take Control of Your Life to Move Through the Pain. I want to say welcome back to Bob, and a great big huge congratulations on the publication of your first book. I'm so excited for you. And also, I'll tell people, Bob was on the show, I think it was last month, and we talked about his new book. So you can check that out, too. When you check out the blog, you can go back there and listen to that whole show, and Bob will tell you all about it. So welcome, Bob.
Thank you, Donna, and thanks for that great book review that you posted. I appreciate that.
Oh, good. It finally got up. Boy, Amazon doesn't make it easy to post reviews. I had an hour and a half fight with them one day to get your review up. It took me an hour and a half in 2 days, but it's up. And I'm hoping that I'll be able to do more reviews like that for other folks. So, yeah. But it was well worth my read, and I was glad to write the review. So thank you for allowing me to be one of those people to, promote your book.
Thank you.
Don Corbelli is the author of A Miracle a Day, One Day at a Time, Hope After Traumatic Brain Injury. Don and your daughter, Veronica, are both survivors of traumatic brain injury. Now, that is really, that's another freaky thing. They were in a car accident together, so that's how that happened. But Dawn and her daughter, Veronica, are both survivors of that near-fatal car accident. And Dawn shared her and her daughter's stories of recovery on Another Fork in the Road on the Brain Injury Radio Network on January 16, 2022. So, again, go to my blog. So type in Corbelli, Corbelli, or you could even probably type in Dawn. I'm not sure I have any other Dawns on there right now, but so any one of those will get you to Dawn's interview. Not only her survivor's interview, the written one, but it also will get you to her on the air Another Fork in the Road interviews. So tonight we're going to have varied opinions on the topic of dealing with fatigue or exhaustion after brain injury. And remember, we're not medical professionals, but we do offer suggestions of things that have worked for us. So welcome, Dawn, Bob, and Megan. And are you ready to jump in?
Looking forward to it.
Absolutely.
Good. Okay, but before we jump in, I just do want to know a little bit about, in a nutshell, so we can get to the topic, what happened to you and how are you even eligible to be on this show? And, of course, you have to be in the brain injury community in some way. So can you tell us, Bob, let's go with you, how did you get to be a caregiver for your wife?
So Shelly, like you had mentioned, Shelly had an accident and January of 2013, we lived up in Idaho, and homemade bottle of ginger ale exploded in our kitchen, knocked her out. It's quite a story. She called me frantic, and I did not know, we had no idea what we were going to be in for. She had to relearn to walk, relearn to talk. She wasn't affected cognitively in the first few weeks too much. She broke her nose. They did an MRI, CT scan. Both those came up negative. And then about, 3 weeks later or so, she started having trouble talking. She went to a neurologist. Neurologist said she, in a very matter-of-fact way, said she had a traumatic brain injury. It was like she was hit with a bomb at war, and she most likely wouldn't be getting any better or much better at all. And so from that point forward, which was just, stunning to hear, obviously. And she just really fought hard and positively. I write about it a lot in my book. And so we were remote. We were in a part of the country that was, 6 hours from good medical care up in near Jackson Hole, Wyoming. No family around, so it was tough. And she's fought hard and still has problems. Still, you know, she can't drive on the major freeways or go into loud places. We really have to be careful when we go out to dinner and make
right.
sure it's. She has, as Donna, you've seen, she has severe PTSD still from the explosion and the force of the. What she went through. So loud, sudden noises really trigger her. So we're careful with that. And then I got, almost 2 years ago, I got COVID, and I got it severely. I was hospitalized 53 days, almost died, came very, very close to dying. So I've been affected since. I have a lot of cognitive issues, massive fatigue issues. I just literally 15 minutes before the show, I woke up from my nap. I take a nap every afternoon. I'm on long-term leave from work, social security disability, all that stuff, which is just really, so, you know, we're the things that I caregive for Shelly for all those years now, she's caregiving for me at times. So we're muddling through together and staying positive and it's quite a journey we're on.
Right. One thing I want to just say there, you said 3 weeks later, Bob, Shelly was displaying signs of speech problems. And I think that's really an important thing for people to hear, because oftentimes when people are like in a car accident, maybe they've had whiplash or something, and they don't realize that they have a brain injury because they didn't get banged up and there's nothing showing, and they say, oh, I don't need to go to the emergency room. I can just go home. But then 3 weeks later, 2 weeks later sometime, you find that there are some residual problems going on that you didn't realize were going to happen. So I always think that it might be a best idea to get checked out, just to be sure and have it on record that, your injury may show signs of problems much later than actually right at the impact. So that's one thing. And one of the other things I wanted to say is you said she's still having some issues. Because, and I always think that too, is that brain injury is forever. It just isn't something that's going to go away. It's not something that's just cured and you can get over it. It's not a broken bone that's going to heal in 6 months and or 6 weeks or whatever it is. Or it's not some of the diseases that can be cured at times, even cancer. You can go into remission and be cured. But brain injury really can't be cured, and it's an ongoing an affliction in your life forever. And one other thing I wanted to just say is you're positive, keeping that positive attitude. Thanks, Bob, for doing that, because I think that's what makes you so much fun to be around. And Lupita's, here we come, because we're coming back down that to the desert pretty soon. So anyhow.
We're looking forward to that. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing you guys again. Let's go to Megan. Megan, can you tell us a little bit about how you got into this position?
So I was diagnosed with lupus when I was 22 years old, and I didn't have a lot of the typical symptoms. Most people with lupus deal with fatigue, which I was certainly dealing with a lot of, but they also usually have a rash in their face and joint pain, and other, more physical rather than cognitive and mental symptoms. Unfortunately, I had a severe flare right at the beginning, and rather than attacking, the normal organs that lupus usually attacks, it attacked my brain. So essentially, my immune system attacked my brain, and it became inflamed. I was fortunately able to recover from that flare, but then 4 years later, I had another really severe brain inflammation flare. So for that one, I had to relearn how to walk, I could talk, but nothing I was saying was actually making any sense. I had some short-term memory loss, which I still have a little bit of today. Trouble understanding space and time. Just so many parts of my brain were affected. So I was bedridden for, I want to say, 6 to 9 months, and then I started walking again. I still deal with some residual symptoms, and with lupus, I still deal with daily fatigue. So it's not like a sudden return to normal. But I'm grateful that, you know, I am able to work a little bit. I'm not bedridden anymore, and I can go back to living alone, which is nice.
Yeah. That independence is so important, isn't it?
You know, just, it really is.
Not having to rely on somebody else, making your own decisions. Yeah, that is a huge step. If that happens in someone's life, that is wonderful. And I'm glad that's going on for you, Megan.
Thanks.
Dawn, let's get a little bird's eye view into you and to Veronica's brain injuries.
Okay, so Veronica and I were on a trip to Walmart just a few miles from home, and we were T-boned at a crossroads, and Veronica was in a coma for 2 weeks and on life support and had to learn everything all over again, and she was in the hospital for 3 months, and I was in the hospital for 3 weeks, and I have a moderate traumatic brain injury. And I actually lost my memory, except for little snippets, for about 7 weeks. But we have, although we have a lot of deficits from our injuries, mine are different than Veronica's. And we always joke that she has half my brain and I have half hers, because we help each other. And I am her caregiver. And we've turned something very negative, a horrific car accident and experience, into something positive, and we're huge brain injury awareness advocates now. And we go to high schools and speak to students, counselors, and teachers about brain injuries, and we've taught over 800 people since last year. So I also have a website.
Wonderful.
Thank you, DawnCorbelli.com. I write a weekly blog about our lives, and I write the good, the bad, and the ugly. It's very truthful, and it doesn't hide anything, but it always ends on a positive note, because that's how we live our lives. So
that's
us
wonderful.
In a nutshell.
Yeah, okay, thank you. And I love the positive there, too, because, you know, that's what we survive on, I think, is that positive, the carrot. Because what else would we do? If you go the other route, you're just going to be miring yourself in misery. And so you've got to keep that carrot right in front of you all the time and keep that positive, uplifting feeling, because the alternative is just not acceptable, because you're going to be miserable, you know, simple fact. So, because David and I do that too. We got through the early years and actually still do, but definitely through the early years with a lot of laughter, with a lot of goofing around and joking, even at the expense of brain injury. You know, when I can say something to him, he knows I don't mean it nasty, but we can laugh at things, you know, and that's, it just helps. I mean, you just do, you know, it laughter actually sometimes has even diffused uncomfortable situations where we
Absolutely.
Might have been feeling a little tense or something, but when you do that laughter, you know, you can just make it light, and it's over. And you don't have the pain of an argument or the or living through that uncomfortable situation that whatever the two of you are in. So I highly suggest laughter, which is positivity also. So great. All right, well, tonight's show is going to be a little different from some of my previous shows. What I did this time is I asked a lot of my friends in a variety of my social media groups how fatigue affects them. And I have to tell you, when I first found out about Facebook in 2014, I just latched on to groups. I joined like 36 groups. I couldn't keep up with everybody, but I went over and read lots of things where everybody got to know a lot of people. Some people who from 14, 9 years later, I'm still friends with, though we've never met in person. But I feel like I know them. For example, even Megan and Dawn, we've never met, but we've talked so much that I do feel like I know you. And Bob, of course, and Shelley, I do know because we were fortunate enough to get together, and we always go out to dinner together because we live near each other, so yay. But so I went and I asked this group of people how fatigue affects them, and I had an overwhelming response. And I want to thank all the participants. So thank you very much. But because of the huge number of responses, I wasn't able to use everyone's answers. And I did get permission from every person up here that I'm going to talk about tonight, but I am only using their first names. That was agreed upon in our discussion of what I can use. So many answers were duplicates, making me realize that fatigue is an overall general problem. And so I just like to get started. So Dawn and Megan and Bob, I'm going to look forward to putting to your input on the following comments from my social media friends. So I'm going to start with something that Michael said. And what Michael said was it wasn't just a physical fatigue that he experiences. He said that he has no trouble, and I'm reading this now because these are quotes. He has no trouble doing anything physically. It's more a general brain-body fatigue or the inability to be productive. Those are the kinds of things that Michael has to deal with. Those are his problems. And he says he's experienced paranoia, fear, and all the other things that come with emotional loss. And that can take a lot of energy. Jonathan says that his brain injury has turned him into an observer who is no longer the star athlete, no longer the runner or the risk taker or the challenger. He says that now he just watches life happen instead of making life happen. And he has turned into someone he never dreamed he'd be. So he procrastinates. He feels trepidation and weaknesses, and all of these keep him away from where his life could have gone. So those are two comments there, and I think brain injury definitely throws a fork in the road for many survivors, and sometimes it's a complete roadblock. Survivors fear the great loss of what their life had been before their brain injury. I think they all do. I mean, because brain injury changes people so much and so drastically that sometimes you don't even recognize the person you are now after the brain injury. And I'm pretty sure that my husband David, who again had his brain injury in 2005, can relate to Jonathan's thoughts as to being an onlooker. Prior to David's brain injury, he was very involved in many aspects of life. He was a runner. He was a race car driver. And he was really out there and in charge of his life. But obviously, since his injury, both of those activities have disappeared, literally disappeared. He can no longer run. He can barely walk at this point. So he can no longer drive a regular car nor a race car. But since his injury, David has sought out new activities. And he has had to adapt his life to make it the best it can be, despite those his disabilities, because again, you've got to look for that positive. So you find things that can make you happy. And I'm going to just say quickly that David has found a cat trike. It's a recumbent trike that he can get on, and he can ride 15 miles a day. He rides 3 days a week when it's not 115 degrees out in the desert. Mostly in the wintertime, he rides his cat trike. He goes on his treadmill. He uses his weights and all kinds of exercise equipment that he does. So he's finally, he's making the best out of this bad situation. So basically, he's making a lemonade. Megan, let's go to you. And how has your brain injury affected your life? And how have you had to change because of it?
I've had to change nearly everything about my life, specifically with managing my energy levels. That's been a steep learning curve. I think the first 4 years after I got sick, I just could not figure out the patterns of the fatigue, because sometimes it would be something where I would do an activity one day and I felt fine after, but the next day or even the following day, like 2 days later, I would be completely wiped out. So, you know, it was just hard to find the patterns. The other thing that was really confusing for me is even if I slept maybe like 10 hours, if I woke up before 10 a.m., I would feel terrible for the entire day. And so, you know, it's almost there's an optimal time that I'll feel okay, and I have to kind of, you know, whether I want to or not, just not be awake in the morning. And so I've had to change essentially like my whole career. Like I'm not able to work a 9-to-5 job, and I wouldn't be able to do those hours necessarily, but I definitely can't be anywhere at 9 in the morning. And so fortunately, everybody that I work with and all my friends and family just know not to call me before 11. And as far as the fatigue, I've kind of learned to manage it the way you would manage money if you didn't have a lot of it. You know, I have to take rest throughout the day. I can't do more than one big activity per day. And I have to make sure that I eat well. And surprisingly, exercise, even though you're exerting energy, for me has been really helpful. But I do have to be very careful about the type of exercise and how long I do it for.
So you're basically relearning your whole life, how to run it again. And it sounds to me like you had a lot of controversy in when and how this fatigue was going to happen, when it happened, and why, you know, when you talk about you would overdo something on one day and then 2 days later you'd feel it. So there was no way of you actually making a pattern of how, you know, of how to deal with it. It was kind of like hit and miss.
Exactly. It took me a very long time to figure it out. I mean, probably partly because I'm stubborn and I really wanted to hang on to my old life. But also, you know, the patterns can be very confusing, and also they can change. You know, sometimes 13 years later, they can change.
And so they can change sometimes for the good and sometimes for the not so good?
Usually for the not so good. You know, they'll usually go back to their regular pattern after a couple of weeks or a couple of months. But I did have something weird happen probably 6 months ago where all of a sudden I was exhausted at night and I felt okay in the morning. Usually it's the opposite. Usually my day kind of happens in reverse of most people's. So I feel like really tired and wiped out in the morning. I have to rest a lot in the morning. And then as the day goes on, I usually feel a lot better. But for some reason, I had this, like, 3 or 4 week period where I woke up feeling okay, and then I was just very tired at the end.
Wow. That must have really thrown a loop for you and make
it
kind of confusing.
It was very confusing. Yeah, and especially since I've kind of rearranged my entire day to not have anything in the morning, which for me kind of works because I'm a musician. Most of my work is at night anyways. You know, if you play a concert, it's not going to happen at 9 in the morning. It's going to happen like 7:30 p.m., 8 p.m.
Yeah.
So
going on.
Fortunately,
so
I didn't have any concerts during that period. That was lucky.
Wow. Well, thank you. Dawn, what are your thoughts on this? How has your life been affected?
I've been tired since the beginning. I've been taking naps, and actually I was doing too much for too many days in a row, and then I'd be down for like 3 days, just stuck in bed. And now I usually take a nap. I told you this before, but my days are split up into 2 days, sort of. Like in the morning, I get everything I need to do done, and then I'm down in the afternoon. I'm really tired, and I take a nap. Mm-hmm. And then I get up again late afternoon, and I make dinner, and I do dishes, and I, like, start my evening so I can spend time with my family. And also, once I get going, I want to go and go and go. Okay, I can go to another store. I can go to another one. And I'll make too many stops, and then I wear myself out. But I've started writing on my calendar on Tuesday and Thursday, stay home, no appointments.
Uh-huh.
That way I can pace myself so much better on the days in between. So that's how I've managed to pacing myself and learning how to do it has been a really hard process for me. But this year I finally have it, and it only took me 15 years.
So, you know, but sometimes it does that. But you know what, Dawn? I like the fact that you put it on your calendar because it makes it tangible then. It's there. And then when someone says, oh, do you want to do something? You want to go to the store or have a lunch on Tuesday? You can be reminded that, no, that's the day that I take off. I need to have that break. Now, this is a question that when you guys are talking about this, it's coming to me because that I want to know even more. What does it feel like to be this overly exhausted, overly fatigued? I know everybody says I can't do anything more. What does it actually feel like?
I will start to literally just like run down and I hit a wall to the point where I can't do anything else. And I start to forget my words more. And I forget what I'm saying in the middle of saying it. My communication becomes very poor, and I have a hard time with processing anyway, and it becomes even worse when I'm exhausted. And it's just like hitting a wall, and then I just can't do anymore.
Does it feel like physical exhaustion, like you've been out digging a ditch for 3 hours? Or does it feel like your mind just can't think anymore? Or is it a combination of both of those?
My mind can't think anymore. And that causes me to be physically tired as well.
Okay. Bob, I think you're ready to say something.
Yeah, I since I got sick, it's crazy because I was always been an overachiever, always been a type A personality, always juggling, always tons of multitasking going on. That was really professionally and personally my biggest strength, my ability to get so many things done, work so many hours, but keep it all together everywhere, you know, from business to home.
And you were proud
home.
Of that, too.
Yeah.
I know you were
and
proud
so
of that.
And then, being Shelly's caregiver, seeing her go through so much with fatigue, and she just still, she has to keep things, you know, compartmentalized, not do more than one thing at a time. She's very disciplined. And can really, you know, she knows her boundaries and knows what she can and can't do and doesn't, you know, really tries to not go outside those boundaries. Well, then I get sick, you know, and as you were well aware, Donna, watching my fight as I'm in the hospital, and then, you know, my oxygen level got as far down as 50. They didn't think I was, you know, I look at my medical records and it says high probability of expiration overnight. Said that for the first two, three nights I was in the hospital. And so I get out, and I'm working while I'm in the hospital. I had the busiest year. I was a grocer for years. And then the last several years I was in the mortgage business and had the busiest year of my life. and had all kinds of things going on when I got sick. So I'm, you know, communicating with my assistant, my team, my every client, you know, getting thinking about clients and doing all this stuff. We're still closing loans while I'm sick. Then I get out and I try to go to work right away. And I'm just making mistakes like I've never made before, forgetting to do things, forgetting to lock loans, forgetting, you know, and it's like, whoa. So I go to the doctor, and the doctor, my primary care, and he says, you're trying to work? And I said, yeah, of course. What else am I going to do? Somebody's got to pay the bills. And he said, look, he said, I'm sure you've got, you know, some type of short-term and then long-term disability offered to you. And I had no idea. You know, it's the type of thing when you're filling out the HR paperwork, you check the box, and then you don't think about it again. Well, anyway.
Yeah.
You know, here I am a year and a half later, stopped working in April, haven't worked since. I just can't put several thoughts together at once. I can't multitask. All the things that I had mentioned that I was so good at, they're gone. And so I had this book already written. So I was going through the editing process as after I got out, and finally got the book out in March. It probably would have been out at least 6 months earlier if I wouldn't have gotten sick. But it every bit of my being. It's so I wake up early still because I'm, you know, a grocer at heart. So I wake up early and I can do some writing early, and my thoughts are, I'm pretty well alert. But as that day goes on, by noon, I am just, I just spiral downward after noon. And I'd say, you know, 5 days out of seven at least, I do take a nap and I feel better. But then I just go, you know, after dinner, I just go downward quickly, and I just can't. My mind's kind of just mush. It's really hard to – I'm always so good at finding words for things, and I just can't anymore for certain things I'm feeling, which is really bizarre. But it's just – the fatigue is like nothing I ever would have imagined. And Shelley always talked about her fatigue, and I tried to empathize with her, but I just couldn't imagine, because I was always the type of guy that could get 5 hours sleep and then work 12 hours and then go to a concert and get home at midnight and then get up at, you know, at 4:30 and do it all again.
Uh-huh.
But now it's just, it's beyond anything I ever would have been able to imagine. I am just engulfed with fatigue every single day. And it's just, and nobody has an answer for it. You know, I'm on all kinds of supplements and you know, I exercise, I walk every morning, but then some people say, oh, you're trying too hard. Other people, you know, you're not doing enough. It's just because nobody knows,
yeah,
especially with this darn COVID thing, the long-term effects, nobody, you know, especially in Western medicine, they don't have a clue how to approach it. So anyway, that's kind of where I am with it.
That was kind of interesting, because one of my questions for you, Bob, was I wanted to know, you know, because I know Shelley has that fatigue thing, and now that you have it, are you understanding her issues more easily than you did before?
Absolutely. I mean, it's added an element to, you know, our relationship and our understanding. And I think sometimes she feels like, well, okay, I've been, you know, welcome to the club kind of thing, right?
Yeah. I'm trying to tell you about this, Bob.
It's just, and so between the two of us, and we're empty nesters now, so we don't have the things pressing in life that we did, and thank God, because, you know, It's just I'm blessed that I'm not, you know, having to try to raise a family with this, or do, or, you know, still be in a high-powered, high-stress career with this because I frankly couldn't imagine it, you know?
Wow. Well, I hope you and Megan and Don sharing these thoughts that our listeners are going to get a little bit more insight into what this is all about. Because those people who aren't experiencing it can't really understand it. And I'm going to go into this next thing because this has something to do with that. And Krista said that during the first years after her TBI, she needed 12 to 13 hours of sleep a night. But she said over time, she slowly improved. And through more than eight years have passed, her fatigue continues. But she said she has found some coping strategies. So that's helpful to know. Yet Krista still says, and this is what I think is interesting, my family doesn't always understand. And that was a quote. My family doesn't always understand. Actually, this whole thing is a quote. But she said sometimes watching TV is all she can do. Her body isn't tired, but her brain won't process. She goes, but my brain won't process anything complicated. I know being active helps me, but some days moving just isn't possible. I might have energy to walk, but not enough energy to pay attention to the traffic. And her anxiety keeps her inside when she's tired. So that's pretty an interesting insight. Megan, Krista's observations about her brain injury and how it affects her and her family is enlightening to me. Her comment about her family not always understanding is a common complaint among survivors. How do you feel, Megan, about this topic and how have people's understanding or not understanding your brain injury affected you?
That's definitely been the case for my family at times, too. I think especially because I don't look sick. I look normal.
Yeah.
And I think partly on their end, they didn't want to believe something was wrong. That was scary for them. But at the same time, you know, during the first 4 years of my illness before I had that major flare, it was really hurtful because I would need to sit down and rest and they wouldn't, you know, want to let me if we were out shopping or whatever. Or, you know, they would just call me in the morning, wake me up, and then I'd feel miserable for the next 3 days. You know, it just wasn't something that they were able to understand. And I think it was because the change was so dramatic. You know, I was always someone who, I don't know if it was just that I had a lot of energy, but I was very determined and I would always just push through. You know, I was like practicing viola. When I was in high school, I was practicing viola 3 hours a day. I was doing well in classes. You know, I did a lot of chores around the house. So I was always busy. I was always moving. And then to kind of see me after I came back from grad school, having to, you know, sit and rest a lot, I think it was just difficult for them to understand. It was almost like their daughter had been replaced by like an 80-year-old. And all of a sudden I was like this old lady in their daughter's body.
Wow. Interesting. Bob, does Shelley have to deal with folks not understanding her exhaustion?
Oh, totally. Yeah, it's just so much of what she just said is relatable for both Shelley and I, for both of our situations. Because you look good, and we're positive, and we're, you know, we spread our message, and you know, it's just so people look at her. They've looked at her for the last 10 years and say, God, it's great. She's doing so well, and she's fine now. And she's not. But we're blessed she's, you know, feels very blessed that she's doing as well as she's doing. And, it's hard to get, like what you said about parents, it just doesn't click for them that there's any way that we could not be as, you know, active and able-bodied as we were, you know, prior. That's very true.
I think that's one of the hardest things that people have to deal with, because, you know, especially when, as you said, Shelley doesn't look like she has a brain injury, neither do Megan or Dawn, you know, look like it. Now, David, on the other hand, has obvious signs, outward signs of something's wrong.
Right.
Maybe people don't know what it is, but they know something's wrong. So there's more empathy, maybe. Whereas with don't, of course, they don't understand it, though. I can say they see that there's something wrong, but they don't really understand it. But with somebody that has an invisible TBI and you look fine, they expect you to be fine. You know, no, your broken bone has healed. You know, 6 weeks are up, you're fine now. Go about your business. Because you can't see the disorganization in the brain. You can't see the confusion going on. You can't see the fatigue that's making you lose your words, like aphasia. And so nobody understands that. They can't see. Now, even for David, they don't understand why he can be so exhausted. Because just, you know, for him, eating or talking or walking is exhausting for him. When we're at a point right now for eating, and we just went out with friends of ours from San Diego, came up and we went out to dinner at a beautiful restaurant overlooking the Santa Cruz Harbor, and we sat. I mean, we couldn't talk. David can't talk that much, so I mean, I was able to talk with our friends. But David had to stop eating if he was going to do any talking. He can't eat and talk at the same time. I mean, I know a lot of people can't walk and chew gum, but David can't even walk and eat and talk because his mouth is not uncoordinated. He's got some paralysis there, and he'll bite his tongue, he'll bite his lip, he'll bite the inside of his cheek, and it's very painful. And he has to concentrate on every single bite that he takes. He has to concentrate on getting it onto his fork and getting it to his mouth. He has to concentrate on chewing it and swallowing it so it doesn't go down the wrong way, because he has a swallow disorder as well. So, and nobody gets that because you don't see it. You don't understand that. And it's exhausting that when we finally go out for a two-hour dinner and Bob, you know, you and Shelley and I and David all go out to dinner. But David is quiet a lot of the time during the dinner. You maybe
right.
didn't notice it so much, but now I'm bringing it up. And probably the next time
yeah.
we go out next month, you'll notice it. Because
we have.
You have noticed it. Yeah, he just can't.
Yeah, absolutely.
And one of the things he does to compensate that is he puts a little piece of tape. Foam tape that we found that will lift his cheek up a little bit and move the inside of his mouth away from his teeth so that he can talk. It's not just eating, it's talking too. The talking will make him bite himself. So he has to, when he's talking, he has to, without even eating, just think, you know, just meet him on the street and talk. He has to concentrate on every word that comes out of his mouth because he'll bite himself and cause extreme pain to the point where one time it lasted about 2 or 3 weeks where he could barely eat anything for 2 or 3 weeks or talk because he had bitten himself so badly on his mouth. Now, so those are kinds of things that people don't get. They don't understand that this kind of thing is going on. I know people wonder why he needs my help. Why can't he walk on his own? Because he can't see outside well enough to walk on his own. Because a stone on the sidewalk will make him stumble and fall. Because a crack in the sidewalk. Because he can't see the curb coming up. And so I'm telling him, I'm like a seeing eye person. And, but people don't get that. Some people in our family don't get that. They don't quite understand it. And they think that, oh, you're just babying him. No, I'm not. That's the last thing I want to do. That's the last thing he wants me to do, because he would prefer to be independent. Nobody wants to be in a situation like this. So, yeah, so it is hard when folks, especially folks that you care a lot about, don't quite get it, or don't, even though you've told them over and over, don't really understand. That's hurtful. It is. But, you know, again, there you go. You just kind of laugh it off and blow it off and say, don't worry about it, because you don't want to lose the friendships, number one, and you don't want to be unhappy about it. You know, so that's what you do. Dawn, what about you? Go ahead, Bob. Do you have something?
I think you do lose. There are some friendships you do kind of lose over it, which is a shame.
Oh, you do, absolutely, yes. That's a whole topic. We've done that topic several
times.
You're
right. We could have a show on that.
Definitely. Yeah. we have definitely lost friends over this. One of David's best, I was just talking about it today when I was driving my kids up to the airport. There was, you know, David lost one of his best friends and didn't know why, because this friend was at his bedside for the whole time he was in the hospital, there for the 3 weeks that he was in the hospital, and then he disappeared. He came to our house, too. So he was there at our house, too, even afterwards, so several months after. And then he disappeared, and we never found out why, other than what his wife told us, that her husband couldn't stand to see his friend like this, in this condition. And,
that's...
You know, but it hurts, because it's a good
right.
friend, and we really miss him. But, you know, I don't know whether you'll ever hear this, but probably not. But anyway, Dawn, let's go to you. How is the support from your family and friends? I know your husband and your girls understand quite well, but what about your extended family and your friends? Understanding how it is on you.
I don't have a lot of super close friends that see it, because some friends you see, it's when you've planned on seeing them, so you aren't exhausted. But I have cut lunches short, and most of the time it's understood, but I haven't had a large experience of people not understanding.
Okay,
I'm very, very
fortunate that way. Yeah, you're
fortunate
that way. Good. Okay, I want to move on to another topic because I'm watching our time, and as always, it goes by so fast. But, so this is Catherine, and Catherine is saying, we're not lazy. We just need more sleep than you. We might need early nights or afternoon naps or both every day. We're doing our best, but neural fatigue is a real monster on our recovery marathon. And then Chelsea wrote, in the beginning, I wanted to sleep all the time. I felt more exhausted after doing small tasks such as dishes, and it made me look really lazy. Now I'm much better, but I get exhausted after long social situations. It's tough to explain to people that are constantly on the go that you need time to rest. And my thought is, survivors are often feel as Catherine and Chelsea do, and I've even heard the lazy part from you guys, but needing that extra rest. That folks, but for Catherine and Chelsea, and for many survivors, they feel like they're lazy because they're not doing what they normally did. And it's not a pleasant feeling. And I often think of the life of a battery when we're talking about this kind of topic. And a full battery might be able to run all day. But the battery of a brain injury survivor may be leaking. It's not working right. It's not full because of the damage done to the brain or the damage done to the battery. So it doesn't start out full. Maybe it's only half full or even just a quarter full at the beginning of your day. But that's all the survivor has available for that day. Another thing I like to think about is, or maybe it's like an old cell phone, the one I used to have, and I'd charge it overnight, and it was fully charged by morning, no problem. Then about an hour or two later, I'd see the battery indicator was less than half full, and most phones will last the whole day. So Then a few hours later, there was very little charge left on the phone. And my friend did the same with her new cell phone, and her phone kept the charge all day long. I think my phone had a brain injury, and hers didn't. So she rarely ran out of battery energy. And it's like her phone was a healthy neurotypical, while my phone was like the survivor of a brain injury. So a typical day of getting up in the morning, having breakfast, getting dressed, going to work, running errands, returning home, preparing dinner, getting ready for bed, may leave only a bit of energy left for a neurotypical. They're tired. You know, everybody says at night, I'm tired, I can't wait to go to bed, you know, because it, those things do wear us out. There's no question. But for a survivor of brain injury with much less energy in his or her battery, it's near impossible to do all those things. So one of the things I like to share with my listeners is the spoon theory, and I've probably talked about it on shows with each of you. I'm not sure, but the spoon theory was introduced by Christine Miserando. And Christine had, I think she had lupus, Megan, just as you did. But she was trying to explain to one of her friends, again, trying to help somebody to understand why she's so tired and why she doesn't have the energy to go out to lunch or dinner or the movie or out dancing at night. So they were at a diner one morning, and her friend, who knew her quite well and seemed to understand, asked Christine, what does it really feel to have lupus? What is it like? And so Christine said she grabbed 12 spoons off the tables around her, and she said that each spoon represented an activity that she could do during the day. And she talked about getting out of bed would cost one spoon. Taking a shower would use up two more spoons. So she only has 12 for the day, but she's already used up three spoons, folks, just getting out of bed and taking a shower. She hasn't even gotten dressed yet or anything. And that's going to cost making and eating a meal, a breakfast or a lunch or a dinner. Each of them is going to cost three spoons. And you can't not eat, because then you're going to be depriving yourself of the fuel that's going to keep you running. So that would cost you spoons too. But going to work, to school, the doctor, or the gym would cost about four spoons. Then there is a site, and I'm going to tell you where the site is, but you can go check this out after the show. But like I said, what about lunch and dinner? Because three spoons cost for breakfast. So what about working on the computer or watching TV? How many spoons are they going to cost? Does she have enough left? What about cleaning the house or studying for an exam? Or what about chatting on the phone or taking pills? You know, we all know we've got that whole thing of pills that have to be taken every day if you've got a brain injury. What about styling your hair? You know, putting in those curlers to make it curly, or using a flat iron like I do to make it straight. What about getting ready for bed? Are you going to just drop into bed with your clothes on and your shoes on? No, it takes time to do that too. So each of those activities uses a spoon or some amount of energy. And some of those, like I said, take more energy than others. So more spoons. So we talked about taking a bath, two spoons. Getting out of bed, one spoon. Making a meal, three spoons. Going to work or school, or maybe going shopping, any one of those things. You've already used up, let's see, 4, 7, 8, 9, 10 spoons. You've got two left to go, folks, and there you might have other things to do. So Steve wrote, as my fatigue increases, oh, okay, wait a minute, I don't want to go to Steve yet. Bob and Megan and Dawn, can you relate to Christine Miserando's spoon theory?
Absolutely. It's, you know, you just have to really kind of take stock of how you're feeling when you wake up in the morning, and you kind of have a little bit of an idea of how the day will go. And for me, it's just a constant checking in with myself. Like, oh, how am I feeling? Like yesterday I went to this really fun outdoor concert, but I had to walk up this really big hill. So when I walked up the hill, I felt okay. And then halfway through the concert, I was like feeling like really tired. But, you know, I just had to sit for a little while and then kind of like regain energy a little bit. And I knew I wouldn't be able to do anything else super active for the rest of the day.
Mm-hmm. That tells me a little bit that you know yourself a little about this. And so basically you used extra spoons to walk up that hill, you know, and, mm-hmm. and then you had to reboot some in order to get back down. Some people aren't able to do that reboot, and so they're going to be kind of stuck. Oh, here, I'm going to give you the website, folks. Write this down. But you don't look sick.com. And then you can find out, I think Christine Miserando wrote a blog piece about this. And I'm actually looking at a chart, which is really kind of neat. So I can just pick things out of this chart and say, this is going to take time. Taking your pills might take one spoon, one piece of energy there. Watching TV, it's kind of passive, so it takes one spoon. Reading or studying might take two because it's not passive anymore. You're actively doing something there. Light housework or driving somewhere or even calling someone on the phone, three spoons. And if you make that phone call really long, you might be doubling those spoons. So it's kind of interesting to see just her examples here. And if you know, you can kind of plan out your day of how many things you're going to do based on how your energy level is and how many spoons you think it would take if you only had 12 spoons left. So, yeah. Okay, I am going to go on. I have several more questions here, but I'm seeing that we have to close down in about 4 minutes. So, you know, I think I better just stop right here. I'm just because we're never going to be able to, never going to be able to get through my spiel, and you're not going to be able to answer me. Any parting thoughts or tips on how to overcome extreme fatigue after your brain injury, or for you, Bob, after COVID? Anybody have any thoughts?
I think a lot sleep of it is a lot.
Yeah, sleeping a lot is very important.
Like if I read for an hour, I probably sleep for two.
Yeah. You don't realize how taxing that is. You know, people sit down to read a book and it's supposed to be relaxing, but your brain is actively working. It's working hard to decipher all those letters into words, into sentences, into paragraphs, into complete thoughts. So yeah, your brain is really working very hard to do that. And sometimes I know there are a lot of people who have difficulty reading and they may have to read something over and over and over again, even to get it into their brain. So it's not an easy task. So sleep does
right.
help to reboot.
And I think it's important not to, you know, to really, we've talked about this, but really be in touch with yourself and not overbook yourself, not overextend yourself. Be willing to say, you know what, I thought I could do this today, but I can't today. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, hopefully people will understand. And if they don't, then, you know, that's like that conversation we had about, you know, the people that don't understand well.
Yeah.
That's their problem. It's not our problem.
Yeah.
Because we got to take
yeah.
care of ourselves. So Shelly and I went on a cruise, the first trip like that we took in well over 20 years. And we were really conscious to, you know, just pace ourselves. You know, we had a lot of fun, but we weren't, you know, we were in, you know, back in the cabin, you know, by 8:30, 9 o'clock, whereas the friends that we went with, you know, they were in the nightclub later, and we just know we can't, you know, we can do that at the time, so Shelly can't because of the noise, you know, she can't be around that kind
uh-huh,
of noise,
yeah.
but, you know, we just have to know what we can do and
uh-huh.
stick to it. And be able to run an audible and make a change when you need to make a change cut whatever you're doing short if you need to cut short.
Pace yourself and keep yourself limited, and you'll be able to do more. In fact,
right.
you know you'll
right.
be able to do more because you won't be laid up in bed like Dawn said that you know she could read for a while and then have to take a nap for 2 hours. So if you're pacing yourself, you're not going to end up in a, you know, having that deficit, real heavy deficit. So, yeah, you get to know yourself. You get to know what happening here. All right, folks, before I don't want us to get cut off because I've been cut off before, so let's not do that. So I want to thank Bob Millsap, Megan Beaudry, and Don Corbelli for sharing so much of your life and offering hope to other survivors. And your input on the fatigue after brain injury is so important. And I hope people will have enjoyed the show and others will eventually tune in to hear about this. And so, again, you can learn more about my guest at my blog, survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. You can read about other TBI survivors and caregivers there as well. There are a lot of resources there. So go check it out. I'm not going to go through all of them because you can go look yourself. But you can read more about my book, Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale, at donnafigurski.com. And that's the site where you'll hear, read all about prisoners and read about, see the cast list of all the pictures of all the people that are in the book, at least the ones that can be named. So remember to tune in every second and fourth Sunday at 5:30 p.m. Pacific time to hear Lisa Dreyer, who is the host of Mess with MS. And I'm not sure there's anybody following me tonight, but if so, there will be somebody on at 7 o'clock. And if you loved my show, tell 10 of your friends. And if you hated it, well, tell 10 of your enemies. That works for me, too. And so I'm going to have to say I'll see you in 2 weeks. That's September 17th. And on that day, I'm going to be talking with Kelly Tuttle. She is the author of After the Crash. So we're going to get to tune into Kelly's life and see what happened caused her brain injury and how she is living and coping with it now. So Don, Megan, and Bob, thank you so, so much for being here tonight. And just let me do a quick before they bop me off here. Folks, don't forget to check out Shake Yourself Free, Take Control of Your Life to Move Through the Pain, written by Bob Millsap, M-I-L-L-S-A-P. Check out Amazon. And also check out A Miracle a Day, One Day at a Time, Hope After Traumatic Brain Injury, written by Dawn Corbelli about her her time with her, and her brain injury with her daughter, Veronica. So on that note, thank you. Thank you, Bob. Thank you, Megan. And thank you, Dawn. And good night, listeners.
Thank you.
Thank you, Donna. Thanks, everybody. Good talking to you all.
Y'all too.
It was wonderful. Bye-bye.
Bye.